Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. House Republicans celebrated last week on the passage of the American Health Care Act, which is headed to a more skeptical Senate for action. President Trump said he was pleased with the effort.
Everywhere we look, Obamacare is collapsing. The House bill is a plan that will save Americans from this disaster and replace it with more choices and more freedom for American families. Most importantly, it will be great health care, and your premiums will come down, and your deductibles will come down. So you'll have better health care at a lower cost. And now I'm calling on the Senate to take action.
We're talking about what's ahead in the for the House plan for health care insurance. Coming up, we'll hear support and opposition to the measure. Joining us by phone is Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau Chief Jack Torrey. Welcome back, Jack.
How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Great.
I want to let our listeners know we invited every House representative from Ohio who voted in favor of the health care bill. Representative Bill Johnson, Steve Stivers, and Pat Tiberi were unavailable. Representative Steve Shabbat, Jim Jordan, Bob Latta, Warren Davidson, Jim Renacci, Brad Wenstrup, and Bob Gibbs did not respond to our request. Two Ohio Republican representatives, Michael Turner and David Joyce, voted against the measure. What reason did they give?
Well, they both come from more moderate districts where there was a great deal of opposition to this. The problem with this, with the House Republican bill is, for people like Turner and Joyce, is that it scales back dramatically the system that Governor Kasich used to expand eligibility to Medicaid, which is the joint federal and state program which provides health care for low-income people. Secondly, it does change some of the insurance markets. It allows states, for example, to file a waiver to opt out of what was Obamacare's requirement that every policy sold through the marketplaces set up by the state and the federal government, which are also known as exchanges, carry 10 basic benefits. The Republican bill would allow states to have a system to apply for changing that so they don't, their insurance companies could offer less expensive policies that would cover fewer things but wouldn't cost as much.
Are there any basic benefits in the Republican plan?
Yeah, they're all there. They didn't change that. What they did, though, is they put a big loophole in there. They said, if the states want to get out of it, then just file a waiver and, you know, we'll let you get out of it.
And that applies to any of the benefits, not they're all up for grabs in that case.
Right. The 10 basic benefits today would include hospitalization, maternity and newborn care, prescription drugs, lab services, ambulance services. So, but by 2020, the state of Ohio, if it wanted to, could ask the government for permission to permit insurance companies to offer a wider range of plans. The idea is this. If you're 27 or 29 years old, you may not need all these benefits, okay? So you might want to just buy a policy that covers catastrophic illness. When I was 29, I might have done exactly that.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the theory behind this is that if people are buying less expensive plans, they're paying lower premiums, and that brings down the premiums. It also offers more competition in the insurance market. The drawback is, are you buying plans that are essentially worthless? And I don't know how they solve that problem.
Yeah, as I look back, I'm pretty sure mine was. But I was young and I was healthy. It didn't apply to me.
Right, right. And that's been the basic problem that Obamacare, which was passed in 2010, has had. There's not a great deal of incentive for younger people to sign up for these individual plans to sole changes. It's important for people to understand the bill itself doesn't impact most Americans. The vast majority of Americans get their care either through their employer or through Medicare, which covers the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
Like myself, getting close, and Medicaid, which is for low-income people. So, but there's always been a group of people, 20 to 30 million people, who work for small companies that don't provide insurance. And so the idea was, well, we'll create these marketplaces where people under that can go and buy a policy. The critics argued by making a minimum package of benefits, you ended up offering people things they didn't want. But as I pointed out, the drawback is you may end up buying a policy that really doesn't do you any good at all.
And there is the basic underpinning of the idea of insurance, that the idea is that, of course, everybody doesn't need it. They pay into it to pay for the ones who do need it.
Yes. But the goal for both Obamacare and the Republican plan is to get as many as people as possible into the markets, because the greater number of people you have, mm-hmm. in theory, prices would go down. The problem with that is you cannot look at healthcare as a commodity like buying a car. We buy a car, we shop around, we look for a car that works the best for the best cost, et cetera. When you're sick, you go to your doctor, okay, and you pay whatever they're charging. I don't sit there and if I want to go to the Cleveland Clinic, for example, I'll go to the Cleveland Clinic. And as a result, we're into this sort of like false debate that you can painlessly reduce costs in healthcare. The only way that you can really reduce costs in healthcare is for Congress to pass a law requiring everybody at age 65 to die. That way, you wouldn't have to worry about paying older, paying the bills of older people.
Mm-hmm.
Being 65, I'm against that law.
And that's the problem. The president said that Americans, if the House plan moves forward, Americans will have more choices, more freedoms. It'll be better health care.
They would, in theory, have more choices. They would, in theory, have more freedom. Whether they're going to get better health care is a claim that nobody can make. But if I'm, let's say I'm 30 years old, and I work for a small company that doesn't offer a policy, I would go through the Federal Exchange in Ohio, and I would say, okay, I'm healthy. I don't even go to the doctor. All I need to do is make certain that if I get in a car wreck, that I'm covered. So I might just get a catastrophic policy or a thing that covers a couple of things. So in that sense, I might have greater freedom to pick those types of policies. But the problem, as I point out, is you don't know if the policy is really going to cover much.
You never know until you get
the
accident.
You may find out the hard way.
Is this a repeal and replace?
No, and no. It doesn't repeal Obamacare. It restructures it. It does repeal the taxes that were used to finance the bill. Mm-hmm. And in classic fashion, if you're a Republican consultant after this bill was passed, it was passed by the House, you might want to bury your head in your hands and cry, because fewer people will get covered under this because of the Medicaid changes. But they eliminate most of the taxes that financed it, most of which fell on people, families earning more than $250,000 a year, or on medical production companies or pharmaceutical companies. So it is a accurate thing to say, if you really want to say, that Republicans cut taxes for the rich so they could throw people off of health care. Now, they'll get all angry and mad about that, but it is reality. That's what they've done.
People like Ohio Governor John Kasich are very opposed to this plan, primarily because it does change the equation for Medicaid expansion. It's a big deal in Ohio. It affects a lot of people in Ohio. What are the changes that would change? What did they do in Washington that might change that?
Well, Obamacare created an enhancement of Medicaid. Medicaid used to cover, I think it was in children or parents of certain families, and it would cover anybody up to 100% of the federal poverty line. What this did was they said, okay, if you're a family of four earning $34,000 a year, That's 138% above the poverty line. You could qualify for Medicaid. And that allowed, and in addition, the federal government under the Obamacare law gave the states a big pile of money. They said, if you want to expand this, go ahead and do it. Well, Kasich took the money. And he extended health coverage to about 700,000 low-income people in Ohio. The drawback is the Medicaid costs are running out of control eventually. You can't, for example, balance the federal budget anytime soon unless you're willing to deal with the health programs and the retirement programs, which would be Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So in essence, what Obamacare did is it gave a lot of money to the states by borrowing a lot of money. So it's deficit money. And what the new bill would do is it would sort of grandfather this program in 2020. If you were in the program at that time, Medicaid expansion, mm-hmm. you could stay there. But people tend to cycle off Medicaid. They go on and off. They go on and off.
In that group, yes.
Yes. And so it's once you go off, you're no longer eligible. So in theory, what they'll do is they'll shrink the size of the program. And now they'll block grant or provide a per capita amount to the states to tailor their own programs. And the conservatives in the House, led by Speaker Paul Ryan, argue that if you give states the freedom to design their own plans, they'll come up with more cost-effective ways to do it. I kind of subscribe to the view that you don't do more with less, you do less with less.
Let's talk a little bit about what people on Medicaid tend to do. They cycle in and on and off because they cycle in and out of jobs, right?
Correct. Right. If you get a job and you're making, let's say you're heading up a family of four, you make $34,000. You make $38,000 a year because you got a raise. Well, you're not eligible for Medicaid. Instead, you would go to one of the healthcare exchanges to buy a policy.
Mm-hmm.
But as the governor has pointed out, most recently in his interview Sunday on CNN, the refundable tax credits being offered by the House Republican plan may not provide enough for people to actually buy a good plan. And in fact, it sort of works against you. The older you get, the less value those tax credits are.
What are the thoughts behind that? Why did they do that in the House? Decrease the tax, the subsidies the older you get?
Well, because they were trying, they actually had a decent reason for doing it in one sense. They were trying to encourage younger people to come on. So again, let's take our 29-year-old. Mm-hmm. You would be eligible for a $2,000 a year refundable tax credit. Well, that would be a pretty good deal for you at that age.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy a policy that would be very affordable. But when you get to be in your late 50s and early 60s, it's quite a different story. I don't know why they kicked those numbers, but nobody seems to think that the tax credits they're offering will be sufficient to keep people on affordable plans.
In March, you wrote that the AARP is airing ads saying stop the age tax in the House GOP's at the then proposed Obamacare replacement. And that's what they're referring to, right?
That's what they're referring to. And the Republicans sort of changed the tax credit for people in their 50s so they could get to $3,500 a year, as opposed to, I think it was $3,000 in the earlier version. I'm still not sure it's going to be enough. Many of these people in their 60s will eventually qualify for Medicare,
mm-hmm.
and they'll be fine at that point. But you're in that group from 55 to 65, and if you work for a company that doesn't insure you, you don't have as many choices and options as you need.
The measure heads to the Senate now, and it's being duly noted that the committee that will be holding hearings on this measure doesn't include any women.
I again go back to my Republican consultant burying his hands in his head in his hands and crying.
It's
like they've come up with every reason they can to have people mad at them. And
why are they doing that? I mean, it doesn't even make any sense. You don't know. They didn't tell you.
No, they didn't tell me. But anybody would have walked in there and said, oh, my God, we got 10 white guys in here. We got to do something about this. Now, I will say this. Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska mm-hmm. will be heavily involved in this. But I just don't know how the Republicans in this. I mean, look, the cynical view is House Republicans said, look, we'll just get anything. We'll pass anything we can. We can go back to our constituents and say we kept those promises for the past 6 years. We've scrapped Obamacare, even though they haven't really done it.
Right.
And they'll have the Senate either fix it or unable to come up with a bill. And if they don't, I've actually predicted a year ago that Obamacare would be the law of the land in 2018.
And you stand by that?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. That's Jack Torrey. He's a Washington, D.C. bureau chief for the Columbus Dispatch. He'll be with us for the hour as we continue our conversation about what's up with the House plan to change health care coverage in the United States. It's now headed to the Senate. They're pretty skeptical. Republican Senator of Maine, Susan Collins, has said they'll start from scratch to draft their own bill, even though she's not on the committee to do it. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, President Trump celebrated during his weekly address that the newly passed GOP health insurance package was a win for Americans. But there are miles to go before the legislation is put to bed. Still with us is Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, Jack Torrey. Joining us by phone as well, Director of Health Policy Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute, Michael Cannon. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
You said after the first Republican effort in March that it would be better to do nothing. Do you feel the same?
I do, because Republicans have an historic opportunity here to improve health care. Right now, in my view and the view of many Americans, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare isn't working. Premiums are spiking. Coverage for the sick is getting worse. And in some parts of the country, so many insurers have left the exchanges that there are no more insurance plans available on the exchanges, and that's a very dangerous situation. So Republicans have been promising that they would repeal the Affordable Care Act for 7 years now, and when they had the opportunity to do it, they just totally caved. I mean, there are spending cuts in here. I don't think that those spending cuts will hold. I therefore don't think the tax cuts will hold. I think the future Congresses will undo them because Republicans get the health policy wrong. And getting the health policy wrong means that all of the other positive, whatever positive things they have in this bill will ultimately be undone. And it'll mean worse health care.
What do you mean get the health policy wrong? You mean there's sort of a intrinsic difference between their approach and that of in the past?
Well, there's really no difference between their approach and Obamacare's approach, and that's the problem. See, the heart of Obamacare are what we call its community rating price controls. They're mm-hmm. part of the pre-existing conditions provisions. And that package of pre-existing conditions provisions, those community rating price controls, are the main driver behind Obamacare's rising premiums between the deteriorating coverage for the sick and the collapse of the insurance markets in places like East Tennessee. And instead of repeal the heart of Obamacare, Republicans leave that provision in place. But worse than that, I mean, they modify it a little bit, but worse than just leaving those community rating price controls in place, they do make changes that, while I would endorse them, they would repeal things like mandated benefits, requirements that you purchase types of coverage you may not want that would increase your premiums. While I do support repealing those mandates because they leave the community rating price controls in place, what is going to happen is that the race to the bottom we are already seeing under Obamacare is going to accelerate. coverage for the sick is going to get worse, and it's going to get worse faster than it already is under the ACA. And I think that's just insanity.
From where you sit, Michael Cannon, can we achieve some kind of medical insurance nirvana in the United States without massively changing the system? I mean, can we still work with that middleman insurance component?
Well, I think insurance provides a lot of value, and I don't think anyone supports eliminating entirely healthcare reform support eliminating entirely the role of some entity as an insurer, because whether you want a completely market system where you will have private insurance companies or a government-run single-payer system where the government is the insurance company, you've always got that middleman there because healthcare is just so expensive for so many people beyond the means of so many people when they develop an expensive illness that you need some assistance. The question is, what's going to be the most stable system of subsidies that we provide to people who are sick, and that also allows for the healthcare prices to come down and the quality of healthcare to improve? And I don't think that either, you know, a single payer system or Obamacare or what the Republicans are proposing now is going to do those things. I think for that you do need the sort of dramatic changes that you suggested, but unfortunately this bill does not provide them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the House Republicans' approach to health insurance, health care coverage in the United States. It's headed to the Senate. Jack Tory, I mentioned that Susan Collins says that they're going to start from scratch, a senator from Maine. Is that pretty much the understanding at this point?
Yeah, but I think they're going to start from scratch, and they're not going to get a whole lot farther because it's hard to imagine them coming up with a bill in the Senate that Ted Cruz and Susan Collins will vote for. Hmm. And let's assume for a second that the Senate parliamentarian says you only need 51 votes to pass this because we'll let this go through what's known as the reconciliation process. Even at 52, getting 51 votes, that's going to be a hard slog. And I just don't know how they're going to pull it off because there's too many people with too many diverse opinions. The most Republican senators don't like the House bill.
Mm-hmm.
But as John Boehner pointed out a few weeks ago, Republicans always know what they're against when it comes to health care. They just have never been able to line up behind a plan. And what they're doing is, you know, I'm watching this with mounting horror because the advocates of government single-payer system are all saying, well, that we got the answer. And I always look at single-payer with a be careful what you wish for, because I don't think Americans will ever accept what Canadians or Brits accept through a government health insurance plan. And I like to use the marvelous example that Vermont in 2011 approved a single-payer health plan and then 3 years later abandoned it because they thought it would be too expensive. When Bernie Sanders is out there talking about single-payer, he doesn't mention that.
You know, Michael Cannon, you've promoted the idea of the interstate and opening up insurance to go interstate. Right now, that's largely not the case. Between 2008 and 2012, five states, Georgia, Kentucky, Maine, Rhode Island, and Wyoming, so a nice broad spectrum of states, passed laws allowing out-of-state insurers not licensed in their states to sell health insurance policies within their borders. No one has taken them up on that offer for lots of good reasons, particularly creating a network of medical providers is hard and expensive. How do you think that would work if it was nationwide?
Well, insurance is hard for lots of reasons, but the main reason I think that insurance companies did not avail themselves of the ability to sell insurance licensed by one state in other states is because you had on the horizon these sweeping changes to the health insurance market that were coming as a result of the Affordable Care Act in 2014 that created so much uncertainty, it didn't make sense for insurance companies to invest in the sorts of investments they would need in order to market across state lines like that. And once 2014 rolled around, there wasn't the sort of variation in the levels of regulation that you had from state to state prior to Obamacare, so there wasn't any incentive for them to do so. The idea behind letting people purchase insurance licensed by a state other than their own is this. You know, every state insurance regulatory scheme that includes the legislature and the insurance commissioner and the insurance laws, they are all monopolists. They provide consumer protection, but they are monopolists when it comes to providing those consumer protections. In other words, you can't buy a different set of insurance with a different set of consumer protections provided by another state. And so you get what monopolies always produce. You get a high-cost, low-quality product. But letting people purchase insurance licensed by a state other than their own would force the regulators to compete. And therefore, we'd be able to avoid a lot of high-cost mandates and price controls that drive up the cost of insurance to the point where people can't afford it anymore, at which point it's not a consumer protection. It's actually harming consumers. So I'm hopeful that that will help. If we remove the Affordable Care Act and then give people the freedom to purchase insurance licensed by a state other than their own, that will reduce health insurance premiums, bring health insurance within the reach of a lot of people who can't afford it today. And the Congressional Budget Office, a nonpartisan budget number-crunching agency on Capitol Hill, they have estimated that if you could avoid those unwanted regulatory costs at the state level, then small businesses, for example, could see premiums fall by an average of 13%. So that's pretty substantial when you're talking about, you know, a health insurance premium that's thousands and thousands of dollars.
By the way, Jack Tory, when is the Congressional Budget Office going to come forth with its analysis of the House measure?
Having anticipated that question, I'm on their website right now, and I don't know when it's going to come out. It shouldn't be that difficult for them to update their report from March. It's they're taking some of the same features of the plan. The taxes will be repealed, I think, a year earlier than originally planned, and the Medicaid changes don't seem to be terribly different. I'm hoping in the next few days, but they work on their timeline, and I they do great work. I always find out when one political party in Washington is attacking the Congressional Budget Office, that's a sign they probably, you know, scored a target there.
Is it unusual that a bill of this magnitude would go forward without the CBO weighing in before a vote?
Yes, but I'm afraid that I'm going to sound cynical when I say this.
Okay.
I don't think the House Republicans really cared. I just think they wanted to get something out of it. Didn't matter. It almost didn't matter what it was. Just get it out of the place. Let the Senate deal with it. There'll be a CBO score for the Senate.
Uh-huh.
And they can go back and tell people, incorrectly, I might add, we repealed Obamacare, because they have not done so with this bill. They've modified it, revised it. They've changed the way the tax credits work, but they have not repealed Obamacare in the way that they originally promised.
We have an email from Richard. I'm interested in what you think about this, Michael Cannon. He writes, we have a for-profit healthcare system. To help lower costs, simply remove the profit. Insurance companies should not profit, think Swiss healthcare, from basic services. We have a health of the insurance company's bill pending. We gave monetized health like we monetized Facebook. We have monetized health like we monetized Facebook.
Well, I think that if insurance company profits were a measure of how well they are serving their customers, how well they are protecting people from the expense of the cost of expensive illnesses, and how well they are promoting quality care, I think we would all be for profit in health insurance. The problem is that right now profits don't always, or even maybe usually, measure that. They're often measuring things like how well insurance companies can respond to Obamacare's incentives to make health insurance worse for the sick, how well insurance companies can game the Obamacare risk-sharing programs or the Medicare Advantage payment system that gives so much money to private insurance companies. I think the main problem with the U.S. healthcare sector is the wrong people control the money. It's right now either government or employers rather than the consumers that the system is supposed to serve. And any economic system is going to serve the people who control the money. So if we want to fix healthcare, we need to take that $3 trillion, $3 trillion plus that we're spending on healthcare, give it to the people the system is supposed to serve. And then I think profit will be a reflection of how well insurance companies and doctors and hospitals and pharmaceutical companies are meeting our needs.
I just to add to that, I assume what the gentleman was asking was, you know, if you take away the profits, you'll have a better system. You know, that's one of those things that we sort of did as undergraduates, and then sort of as we grew older, we decided that no, there's a problem there. I know the Fraser Institute in Canada has a lot of critics. But they document the wait times under the Canadian Medicare system. And those are wait times for from between referrals and medically necessary treatment. No American's going to tolerate that. I've always said that if a political party gave Americans single payer, they would be obliterated in the next election. I'd be curious about the gentleman from Cato on that, because I think the documentation is fairly persuasive that you wait a lot longer in Canada.
I think Jack is correct. That's accurate. I think he's also correct when he points to the experience of Vermont. You know, Vermont rejected a single payer plan because the taxes would have been too high, and they would have only had to pay for a portion of their single payer system. The federal government, which is to say you and I, would be paying for a large portion of Vermont's single payer experiment. So even in left leaning Vermont, the taxes associated with single payer were much too high. So that sort of gives rise to this myth that if you have a single payer system, it automatically saves money. It wasn't going to do that in Vermont.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's a wide-ranging conversation about what came out of the House in terms of health care coverage for Americans. It's headed to the Senate, where some are saying they're going to start from scratch again. And who knows, maybe Jack Tory's right. There'll still be Obamacare in 2018. Jack Tory is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. He's with us by phone also. And I guess right now I have to say goodbye to Michael Cannon of the Cato Institute. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Cannon is Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We are talking about the American Health Care Act, which passed in the House last week. The measure moves on to the Senate, where its prospects are unclear at this point. Still with us is D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch, Jack Tory. Joining us by phone is the Director of Health Policy for the Independent Women's Forum, which supports the GOP health care bill, Hadley Heath Manning. Welcome to the show, Hadley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You say it's a good deal. Why?
Well, it's a good deal. It's really an effort, I think, from the GOP to address some longstanding issues in our healthcare system and some of the shortcomings that we saw from the Affordable Care Act. So the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's commonly called, has some problems today that if we don't address, will continue to head in the wrong direction. It's not just the Aetna CEO, but a Princeton economist. Uwe Reinhart says we're in a death spiral with some of these exchanges. And so really stabilizing the insurance markets, those individual insurance markets, and what we call the Obamacare exchanges is one goal of the legislation. Reforming Medicaid is another goal, repealing many of the taxes in the Affordable Care Act. So from that perspective, this bill would move our healthcare system in the right direction.
You write that in its latest form, the bill balances concerns about high costs and limited choice with protections for pre-existing conditions. You disagree with a lot of the way pre-existing conditions have been described in criticizing the measure.
That's right. So, you know, I think it's important to understand people have different meanings when they use the term pre-existing condition. You know, according to sort of the dictionary definition, a pre-existing condition is just, you know, a health condition that you had before you sought health insurance coverage. And sometimes people, when they hear this term, they think it means anyone with a pre-existing condition is someone who's uninsurable or someone who, if they sought insurance in a market, would be denied coverage. On the other hand,
or pay much higher rates.
Right. So on the other hand, there are certain risk factors. You know, for example, before the Affordable Care Act, if you were a woman, it's likely that you paid a slightly higher premium than a counterpart with, you know, similar health and age who is a man. That doesn't mean that being a woman was a pre-existing condition. It meant that being female was considered by many insurers as a risk factor. Of course, the Affordable Care Act outlawed gender-based pricing, and the American Healthcare Act will continue to outlaw gender-based pricing. And so I think, you know, there are some health factors or risk factors that could contribute to a higher premium, but they don't necessarily mean you'll face an unaffordable premium or that you'll be denied coverage.
You're saying that the measure that came out of the House still bans gender-based discrimination.
That's right.
Is that your understanding, Jack Torrey?
That's my understanding as well. That's what the House, for example, when they didn't eliminate pre-existing conditions. They didn't say, well, people with pre-existing conditions are back to where they were before. But they made it possible for states to charge more. And if they charge more, then if you can't afford it, then they're going to throw them into these high-risk insurance pools, which Governor Kasich has argued, and I think he's quite correct on this, there's not enough money in there to handle that. And it's also with the basic benefit package. As I said, there were 10 basic benefits required by Obamacare. States can petition or ask a waiver. I try to avoid that word. It's a horrible word. For the federal government to ask the federal government for permission to allow their insurers to offer a wider variety of plans. Now, if you do have a pre-existing condition and you let your policy lapse for more than, I think, 63 days. I think
62, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, then you got a problem. So, you know, you may get a policy that will just cost you an astronomical amount of money.
Hadley, go ahead.
If I might add to that, mm-hmm. if you do face an offer of coverage that is unaffordable, and this is the case before the Affordable Care Act as well, and mm-hmm. I want to make it clear, you know, I'm not arguing for going back to the status quo before Obamacare, but there are some misunderstandings about how that world operated. And if you were offered coverage in a state that operated a high-risk pool and your premium was unaffordable in the private market, if you could go to the high-risk pool and find a premium there that was more affordable, and states capped their rates in the high-risk pool between 125% and 200% of the standard market rate. So people with a pre-existing condition who could not find an affordable offer of coverage in the private individual market could go to the high-risk pool and find a premium there that was rated at a certain percentage above the standard market rate. And so that was intended to be a safety net. Now, whether those high-risk pools functioned effectively in every state or were managed well, I understand some of them had waiting lists and mm-hmm. some of them, you know, didn't have had out-of-pocket costs that people couldn't afford. Certainly, you know, those problems should be addressed, and I hope that the GOP plan will provide the right incentives to states to have the right kind of risk-sharing program so that people will be protected. But the idea that your only option is to go into sort of a wild, wild west of a private marketplace and face an astronomical premium, that's not the end of the story. There should be other options for people with pre-existing conditions, and that's the way that the GOP plan is designed.
If the House GOP plan was adopted lock, stock, and barrel right now, Hadley Heath Manning, consumers out there still wouldn't know what they're up against because of what the states might ask for in terms of waivers.
Right. So, and we have to keep in mind that, you know, there's two sides to this conversation. So some people live in states that, let's say that your state applies for a waiver and they can waive the essential health benefits and they can waive the community rating rules in Obamacare or in, under the new law. And there are some people who live in those states who their story looks a lot like this. They had an individual market plan that got canceled because it was not compliant with the Affordable Care Act. It didn't have the essential health benefits. When they went back into the market to buy a new plan that was compliant, they saw a premium increase of double or triple or sometimes four times what they were paying before. And so there are some customers who are hoping that their states will apply for these waivers so that they can find a plan that maybe doesn't cover as many of the services, but that's coverage that they don't want or need, coverage that they certainly don't want to have to pay for. And so there are certainly some people, many Americans actually, who've experienced premium increases and higher out-of-pocket costs as a result of the Affordable Care Act, who are hopeful that their state leaders will take advantage of the opportunity to lower rates for that group.
How do you suss out the premium increases by way of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, from the premium increases that lots of us, most of us, were seeing anyways for the last 15 or 20 years?
Right. So, you know, you can look at the employer insurance market, which is where most privately insured people continue to get their health insurance. And we were seeing big increases there, and we continue to see big increases there. But when we look specifically at the Obamacare exchanges, and these are plans for individuals that buy insurance on their own, typically available through the exchanges, you know, the average increase just in the past year was a 25% increase, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. That's very high. Even when you compare it to sort of the normal medical rate of inflation or the normal increases that people were used to before the Affordable Care Act, that's a huge jump up. And a lot of that is due to the fact that, as I mentioned at the outset, those exchanges are in a death spiral. The insurance companies who are saying, we're experiencing financial losses because these pools are sicker than what we expected. We're offering higher rates to try to make up for the fact that we didn't price these plans high enough in the beginning to account for all the claims that we were going to see from this population. So I believe that the Affordable Care Act is particularly driving higher premiums, especially, I mean, I'm talking about the unsubsidized premiums. You know, I recognize a lot of people get financial help to buy these plans. And that's another part of the American Health Care Act. They're restructuring those tax credits. But for the people who are paying the unsubsidized premiums in particular, they are really, truly suffering at the hands of Obamacare.
Email from Carl asks, does the new bill cover maternity? Hadley Heath Manning, it depends on what the states ask for in terms of waivers.
That's right. And there are incentives in the bill specifically to encourage states to get this kind of coverage on the book. So I think they understood, you know, from the first iteration of the Affordable for the American Health Care Act, there was some pushback on this point about maternity and preventive services, substance abuse coverage, and things like that. And so they have included some incentives for states to try to ensure that people have access to that type of coverage. So it's not something that every state, you know, if you get a waiver from the essential health benefits, then that's not something that every state is going to require every person to have. And again, you know, two sides to the story. If you're a young person and you're not expecting to have any costs related to maternity, you may want to choose a plan that doesn't cover maternity and you could save on your monthly premium.
Donna in Medina, you're on the air. Hi, Donna.
Yes, that was my question. It's on premiums. This is my second year using the ACA, which is CareSource in Ohio. Last year, the deductible was $7,000. This year, it's $10,000. And I'm wondering if there are any estimates out there yet what might happen to the 55 to 65-year-old age group premiums and deductibles under the House plan.
Hadley Heath Manning?
So it's interesting that she asked specifically about this group because this is the group. Women aged 55 to 64 saw the highest premium increases of any group under the Affordable Care Act. And the CBO has come out with some estimates about premiums for all groups on average under the Republican plan. And they say initially they expect premiums to continue to climb in 2018 and 2019. And you know, that might cause some political problems for Republicans. But in the long run, they expect this bill to result in lower premiums. And so I hope that people will, you know, take that into consideration as they see sort of the short and long term effects of the bill.
Thanks, Donna. Another, let's see, Marie in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Marie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Ann.
Sure.
I could have a debate, like, all morning. But
sure, but we only have a few minutes.
I know. The bottom line for me is, why in God's name are we talking about health care as a financial issue and not a wellness issue, not a care for people issue? That keeps getting shoved under the rug. I'm no fool. We pay for our health care. I'm on Medicare, and I'm very grateful. But we still have expenses, mm-hmm. and we pay them. I know that takes money, but it's a matter of wellness. It's a matter of people being able to have the happiness that is promised in our Constitution.
And do you feel like this has been missing from the conversation?
How often have you heard it?
Mm-hmm. Jack Torrey?
I don't think there's any question that there should be greater incentives for people who actually do a better job at taking care of themselves. If you smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day and you eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner at Dunkin' Donuts and you don't get any exercise, you're not going to be as healthy as other people. If you want to have an insurance policy that encourages you to go and deal with problems before they exist. Now, there's certain things you can't do anything about. I mean, cancer is luck of the draw, bad luck of the draw. But a lot of this it can be attributed to lifestyle choices. And, I quit smoking on my 28th birthday. I've had a cigarette in, 65? Where you do the math on that
100 years ago,
one.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty good, if you're a heavy drinker, heavy smoker, heavy eater, there's a better chance you're going to end up with lung cancer, emphysema, diabetes, heart trouble, you name it. And so she's 100% right. But a lot of that is the person's personal responsibility to make those decisions. I think if you go to any restaurant in Columbus or any place like that, you'll see people who are making different decisions.
Hadley Heath Manning, what about that? The idea that we're not really talking about what's best for people's health, but we're talking about what's affordable. We're talking about in terms of dollars and cents, in terms of wellness, instead of in terms of wellness.
Well, I agree with Jack. I think this is a big part of the sort of clash of worldviews in the healthcare debate. You know, there's, on the one hand, you can treat healthcare as a commodity. On the other hand, a lot of people argue that it is a right, And on the one hand, people point out that there's so much that we can control, the choices that we make. I live in Colorado. I recently saw a report showing that the highest life expectancy in the United States is in the high country of Colorado. And it's no surprise because the people there really pursue sort of a very healthy lifestyle, and they do a lot of hiking, and that's just part of the culture in that part of Colorado. On the other hand, there's a lot of things that happen to us in the healthcare system that we cannot control. You know, Jimmy Kimmel just gave this very moving monologue about his child who was born with 2 heart defects. And so depending on which side of the healthcare debate you're on, you may focus on either of those two things. You may say, well, the choices people make should have consequences. On the other hand, you may say, well, some of this is outside of people's hands. But ultimately, when we give consumers the most control over their healthcare dollars, that's where we find not just the most efficiency, but the greatest welfare for people as well.
Hadley Heath Manning, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Hadley Heath Manning, Senior Policy Analyst and Director of Health Policy at the Independent Women's Forum. Jack Torrey, as always, thank you so much for your help today. Appreciate it.
Great.
Enjoyed being here.
Jack Torrey, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Obviously, we're not done talking about this issue. We will continue into the future. Thanks for staying with us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.